KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Many think he was from a bygone era, but in reality, he saw well into the future.
Former President Jimmy Carter was honored by political leaders, friends, and family at Washington's National Cathedral.
For Thursday, January 9th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Wildfires continue to rage across Los Angeles.
We hear from the community of Altadena about the destruction they witnessed.
I don't have a word in the English language that can express what this experience has been like.
And I speak with CIA Director Bill Burns as he wraps up 4 years running the Central Intelligence Agency.
There's every reason for political leaders to recognize that enough is enough and, you know, it's time to make a deal.
Also, after more than 2 years without a president, Lebanon has picked a new leader.
First the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. In Los Angeles, crews continue to battle wildfires that have turned sections of the city into a hellscape. Fire officials say one of those blazes, the Eaton fires, destroyed more than 5,000 acres, or structures, rather. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports on the nearby Palisades fire from a vantage point along the scenic Pacific Coast Highway.
I'm standing here on Pacific Coast Highway. It's really this eerie smell, among other things. You can smell the sea over here, the waves crashing, and then it's just this sulfury, charred smell of burning rubble and vegetation. I'm even looking at a fire truck trying to save a house right in front of me here. Doesn't look like they're going to do it, but embers have been still flying in and catching things on fire. Up and down this highway, hotel over to my right is totally burned. I can see in the distance the Getty Villa, the famous museum. It appears to be intact, although the vegetation all the way up right around it is burned.
At least five people have died in the fires, though officials expect that number to rise. Supreme Court has rejected a request by President-elect Donald Trump's lawyers to halt his sentencing for his conviction on charges stemming from hush money paid to a porn star. The court, in a 5-4 decision, denying a last-minute bid to halt the sentencing, which is scheduled for tomorrow. Trump was found guilty last May of 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up a $130,000 payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels ahead of the 2016 election. Trump is the first former or future president to be convicted of a crime. He takes office again later this month after winning re-election. The Senate overwhelmingly voted to begin debating legislation allowing for the detention of unauthorized migrants who are charged with some crimes. NPR's Deidre Walsh reports the bipartisan immigration vote is the first policy pushed by the new Senate Republican majority.
The Lake and Riley Act is named after a Georgia nursing student who was murdered last February by a man from Venezuela who was in the U.S. illegally and had been previously arrested and charged for having stolen goods. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso says he's glad lawmakers from both parties now back it.
Protecting Americans from the dangers of a broken border makes sense to, I believe, most if not all of our citizens.
The House of Representatives approved the measure on Tuesday in a bipartisan vote, with 48 Democrats joining all Republicans. But opponents say it fails to allow due process and defers federal authority to state law enforcement leaders. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
With some hedge funds buying up single-family properties in the state, New York Governor Kathy Hochul says she plans to introduce legislation requiring a 75-day waiting period before big investment firms can place bids on new homes. There are concerns about large investment firms gobbling up housing stock at a time there is a shrinking supply. You're listening to NPR. Nearly two dozen kangaroo species went extinct some 40 to 65,000 years ago. The question is why? Reporter Ari Daniels says hundreds of teeth may hold an answer.
Sam Arman took a detailed look at the teeth of more than 900 kangaroos from both fossils and modern animals.
Whenever an animal chews its food, the food leaves marks, microscopic scratches on the surface of the teeth.
Armin, who's a paleontologist at a natural history museum in Central Australia, used those scratches to figure out what the ancient kangaroos ate. His answer, a mix of shrubs and grasses, suggesting that a changing climate that wiped out a single group of plants likely wasn't behind the extinctions. Rather, he thinks humans, who arrived in Australia around this time, had something to do with it. Other paleontologists disagree, citing evidence that climate change did play more of a role. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
A 175-pound tortoise named Tiptoe is among the survivors of the California wildfires. Tiptoe and his owner, Caitlin Duran, were forced to flee their home in Pacific Palisades. The TikTok star, with upwards of 4 million followers, rushed to safety by his owner, who says her parents' home, where she filmed content with Tiptoe, was lost in the fire. Duran says she, her family, and the tortoise are safe in Marina Del Rey. Others who've reportedly lost their homes in the Palisades fire include actors Anthony Hopkins and John Goodman. Crude oil futures prices moved higher today. Oil up 60 cents a barrel to end the session at $73.92 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Former President Jimmy Carter will be laid to rest today in his hometown of Plains, Georgia. He died last Sunday at the age of 100. He was honored with a national funeral service in Washington, D.C. this morning. That included a eulogy from President Biden.
Throughout his life, he showed us what it means to be a practitioner of good works and a good and faithful servant of God and of the people.
Carter's funeral brought together all five living presidents, including Biden. NPR's Stephen Fowler watched today's funeral. He joins us now from Atlanta. Hi there.
Hey there.
Stephen, these state funerals, they combine highly choreographed rituals with personal touches of those who are being remembered. How would you describe today's service for former President Carter?
Juana, it really did feel more personal than presidential. I mean, you had the military honor guard and this ceremonial pomp and pageantry, and it was in this magnificent cathedral, but the tone of the service really focused more on Jimmy Carter, the post-presidential humanitarian that truly lived as a man of the people. That's what we heard from people that knew him best throughout his life, like former United Nations Ambassador Andrew Young, who delivered the homily, and this from Carter's grandson, Jason.
Maybe this is unbelievable to you, but in my 49 years, I never perceived a difference between his public face and his private one. He was the same person, no matter who he was with or where he was. And for me, that's the definition of integrity.
Carter is remembered for his four decades of work after leaving the White House, more so than for his time as president. Tell us how that was reflected in the remarks.
Well, for one, Carter lived so long after taking office that he survived two of the planned speakers at his funeral, his Vice President Walter Mondale and President Gerald Ford, the man he beat to win the White House. Both Mondale and Ford wrote touching tributes to Carter that were then read aloud by their sons that also touched more on the humanity of Jimmy Carter than his presidential achievements. But Stuart Eisenstadt, who served as a top advisor for Carter, used his address to make the case that Carter was not a failed leader and was, quote, as close to being a Renaissance man as any president.
Farmer, businessman, nuclear engineer, naval submarine officer, woodworker, painter, fly fisherman, music lover, poet, author, Sunday school teacher, creator of the Carter Center.
Eisenstadt went on to say, in a message that sought to both define and defend Carter's legacy, that while Jimmy Carter might not be a candidate for Mount Rushmore, quote, he belongs in the foothills. And Biden said that Carter was a president who was ahead of his time, praised his character, and 100 years of a life fully lived.
Indeed. And tonight, Carter's casket, it will return to his hometown of Plains, Georgia, where he will be buried. Tell us about those plans.
There's going to be one final ceremony today at Carter's Maranatha Baptist Church. That's where he taught Sunday school often well into his 90s. Instead of being buried at his presidential library or somewhere else more prominent, he'll be buried beneath the willow tree in the backyard of the family home next to his wife, Rosalind, who died in 2023.
That's NPR's Stephen Fowler in Atlanta. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On a shelf in his office at CIA headquarters, Director Bill Burns keeps a tiny scaled model of a house. It's the house in Kabul, Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri was killed by a U.S. drone strike in 2022. When we went out to interview him this week, Burns pointed to the exact balcony on which Zawahiri was standing. There was pride in his voice. The CIA had never stopped looking for the guy, even more than two decades after 9/11. But it was also a reminder of challenges, of adversaries that will outlast any single CIA director. As Burns wraps up 4 years running the Central Intelligence Agency, I wanted to ask about some of them, starting with Russia and Vladimir Putin.
I know you're fond of joking that most of your gray hair came from dealing with Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. I will note your hair is entirely gray as we sit and speak today. You're about to leave government service. Mm-hmm. Vladimir Putin is still running Russia, is marking a quarter century doing so, and shows no signs he's going anywhere. So what's your best advice to your successor for how to handle him?
Oh, you know, I've had a couple of conversations with my successor, with John Ratcliffe, and I'm not sure he needs my free advice.
But you must have picked up a tip or two along the way.
Yeah, no, I certainly have in my long experience dealing with and interacting with Putin. I mean, I think he's a big believer in control and intimidation. He's deeply suspicious of people around him and always looking for vulnerabilities that he can take advantage of. And so, you know, as the new administration thinks about the prospect of negotiations over Ukraine in this year, in 2025, the issue, I think, is going to be how do you help President Zelensky and Ukraine sustain enough leverage to ensure that those negotiations are not just on Putin's terms? And how do you continue to inflict costs on Russia so that Putin understands that time is not necessarily on his side, which is what I think he believes today.
As CIA director, I know you don't do policy, mm-hmm. but you do assess what is working and what isn't.
Yes.
Did the U.S. hold back too much in an effort not to antagonize Russia in terms of weapons it supplied, in terms of limits on what Ukraine could do with them?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there were some, you know, very careful choices that the president made over the course of this that enabled the Ukrainians not just to hold the line, but also to make some significant advances against the Russians, especially in 2022.
And but we're in 2025 and they're saying morale is low, they're being decimated.
There are, but I mean, the most recent supplemental assistance package, which, you know, was the subject of pretty intense debate in the Congress. I spent, you know, hours with the new Speaker of the House talking to him about my experience on all those travels to Ukraine and what was at stake. And, you know, I think that's provided, at least in terms of, you know, weapons and ammunition and equipment, you know, a boost for the Ukrainians too. But they do face a huge manpower challenge. It's not a question of their courage or tenacity, which I don't doubt for a minute. But, you know, that manpower disadvantage is something that Putin's taking advantage of.
The Middle East. Who or what is blocking a ceasefire on Gaza at this point?
You know, at this point, I still think there's a chance. I mean, I've learned the hard way not to get my hopes up. I do think there remains a chance to get a deal, and we'll certainly in this administration work very hard at that right up until January 20th. And I think the coordination with the new administration on this issue has been good. So I think there's a chance. I mean, and the thing that I always remember is that this is not just an abstraction. I mean, this is not just about brackets in negotiating texts. It's about human beings. It's about hostages held in hellish conditions. It's about their families with whom I meet regularly. And it's about Gazan civilians who are also in hellish conditions right now and suffering terribly, especially through this winter. So there's every reason for political leaders to recognize that enough is enough, that perfect is rarely on the menu in the Middle East, and that, you know, it's time to make a deal. And I do think the negotiations that are going on right now are quite serious and do offer the possibility, at least, of getting this done in the next couple of weeks.
You just said coordination on this issue, the Middle East, has been great with the incoming team, which suggests other issues it has perhaps been trickier?
No, it's just the only one that I was speaking to is on this one, too. And that's the one I'm most familiar with anyway, as well.
ISIS, which I was not expecting to come in and ask you about in 2025, but we have a terror attack, a horrible terror attack in New Orleans last week, which is raising fresh questions. The man who drove that truck into the crowd had an Islamic State flag on his vehicle. The FBI says he posted videos proclaiming support for ISIS. What is the state of ISIS?
Well, I think, you know, we're quite concerned, as has been, you know, FBI, about the rising threat posed by ISIS, especially ISIS Khorasan based in South Asia.
That's how you would describe it, a rising threat?
A rising threat, yeah. We can see the external plotting that that particular branch of ISIS is engaged in. And, you know, we're very sharply focused as an agency on dealing with that threat. You know, supporting the FBI in the New Orleans case, where, as the FBI has said publicly, their belief is that the man who perpetrated that horrific act was inspired by ISIS but operated alone. But we're quite concerned about other instances in which, you know, ISIS is doing external plotting. I mean, last summer we shared intelligence with our Austrian counterparts that helped protect tens of thousands of concert goers at a Taylor Swift concert in Vienna and resulted in the arrest of four ISIS operatives. We also, under the duty to warn that we operate under, provided the Russians and the Iranians with advance intelligence on plots we knew that ISIS was engaged in, and that resulted in, you know, a large number of deaths in Moscow in a terrorist attack there and in Iran.
So there are all these efforts, and yet ISIS is still able to reach, still able to inspire a 42-year-old realtor in Houston. Mm. Do you have any visibility into how?
No, I mean, I think it's a complicated story in that 42-year-old's case of, you know, lots of other failures in his life, apparently. So it's always hard to understand how people are inspired. But the danger that, you know, ISIS can pose, even if it's not involved in the actual plotting or carrying out of an act, through its ability to inspire people, is a significant threat. Yeah.
Part one of our exit interview with CIA Director Bill Burns. Elsewhere on today's program, he reflects on his 4 years at the helm.
I've taken 84 trips overseas during that time, covered more than 1 million miles. And, you know, it's just deepened the pride that I have in the work of this agency.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Sony Pictures Classics with The Room Next Door, starring Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton. Years later, two friends meet again in an extreme situation. Directed by Pedro Almodovar, now playing select cities only in theaters. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Firefighters in California are still battling a patchwork of blazes throughout Los Angeles. These fires have destroyed entire neighborhoods, and tens of thousands have been ordered to evacuate. As officials in the state navigate this horrific scene, many are wondering how the federal government will step in to help. For more on that, we're joined by Lori Moore-Morrell. She's the fire administrator for FEMA and is in California. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for having me and for focusing on this topic.
Thanks for being here. I just want to start by having you briefly describe for us what you've seen there on the ground in California.
Absolutely. I am joined this afternoon by the FEMA administrator. We are literally just getting a brief on the Palisades fire, and there are multiple fires burning here. They are disparate, so they are some distance from each other, but all large nonetheless. The Palisades area looks, as you might imagine, like a war zone. The fire has moved quickly. There was heavy fuel loads here, not just vegetative fuel, but also the structures. And once the structures were ignited with the wind speeds that we had, this was unfortunately the perfect firestorm. And so the fire has moved very quickly. It's destroyed thousands of structures. We're still getting an accurate count there. But it is a devastating event for this community.
Right. I mean, the people who are impacted by these fires, and there are so many, they obviously have some immediate needs. Here in the short term, what is FEMA doing to help people today who are without homes, without power, without their businesses?
So given that we have President Biden has awarded a major declaration or presidential disaster declaration, that opens up a lot of resources, primarily individual assistance that will help them jumpstart their recovery. That can be everything from temporary housing to just survival resources. And so we'd like people to go to disaster.gov to find those and apply for those resources. There are some immediate funds that are available for immediate needs. That is life safety needs, food, water, shelter. But then make application for longer term recovery under individual assistance. And so given that this has happened so quickly and we got a major declaration so quickly from the president, that has really expedited individuals' opportunity to get relief.
I wonder, you talked about the fact that, you know, we're dealing with this patchwork of fires. It's not just one fire and it's hitting in different places. I wonder, that presents a challenge in response for the city of Los Angeles to be able to respond all at once. How does that make you think about this disaster differently?
You know, all disasters are unique, and in this one, it was an immediate combination of L.A. City and L.A. County because of the way that the fires ignited, and they are so disparate. Well, they had already pre-positioned many resources, and so they were able to get on the ground really quickly. CAL FIRE was engaged almost immediately. We have resources that have been requested from nearby states in the West that are on their way here, and many already arriving. Nevada Task Force 1 is already here. And so we have a lot of these resources that were brought to bear. The issue is, and their response was as effective as it could be with the resources they had, and they are the best here on the West Coast at fighting these kinds of fires. This fire, however, was orders of magnitude beyond some they've seen in the past. Because of the fuel load that I mentioned, because of the close proximity of the structures, because of all of the things that are combustible. So it's not just the structures. You have to think about what's around them. Is it wood fences? Is it sheds? How about the vegetation? How many trees? Are those trees dry? We know they are from the drought that's been here.
Right.
And so what is the actual fuel load? You enter wind into that, and then we are, as we say, off to the races.
Absolutely.
We have what is more known as a wildfire or conflagration, where we had structure to structure, horizontal fire spread, and no firefighting regiment is going to get in front of that.
Yeah.
And so they moved to life safety, they moved to rescue, and they stay on suppression and protecting the perimeter from spreading as best as possible.
Now jump in here because we've got about a minute left. I think a number of us remember that deadly campfire that swept across Paradise, California about 7 years ago that killed nearly 100 people, destroyed thousands of structures. I wonder, as you're thinking about what a timeline for recovery might look like, are there lessons you take away from that fire about how long it might take to make people whole?
You know, this is going to be a long-term event. The devastation that is here is monumental. It is, you know, spans a great number of communities. And so we really want people to start early. Go to disasterassistance.gov or call 1-800-621-3362. Make your application early. Stay with the process and be prepared to move forward. We have to build back in a place that it, where it's going to be fire-prone. We want them to build back with fire-resistant. Use the code, understand defensible space, and in the moment, however, continue to listen to local authorities and follow the instruction that was given by FireTech in the area.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. FEMA Fire Administrator Lori Moore-Morrell, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
After more than 2 years without a president, Lebanon has chosen a new leader. Jusufone is already head of Lebanon's military. Now he will be president. As NPR's Emily Fang reports, he has a lot of work ahead of him.
I'm outside the parliament building where car after car is arriving with members of parliament, foreign dignitaries.
They gathered in Beirut to try for the 13th time to pick a leader. Their last president finished his term in 2022.
It's now long overdue that we really need to have a new president.
That's Abdulrahman Bizri, an independent member of parliament. He threw his support behind Jusuf Aoun, a Maronite Christian, which by convention in Lebanon's highly sectarian society is a prerequisite for being president. Aoun is already commander of Lebanon's military, so technically he ran in breach of a constitutional restriction that bans those already holding office, like his, from running as president. But he also commands widespread respect, says another independent parliamentarian, Elias Jardeh.
That was our vision, that for a person who can be a bridge and can give confidence to all parties in Lebanon.
Convince all parties in Lebanon, but that has been easier said than done. Initially, Aoun's candidacy was blocked by other sectarian factions, including the political wing of Hezbollah, the Iran-backed fighting group. But now Hezbollah's political clout has been severely diminished after a damaging war with Israel. And in a second round of voting on Thursday, Aoun got the votes he needed. Not everyone was happy about this. He's perceived as overly U.S. and Saudi Arabian friendly. Aoun, in his acceptance speech, tried to project confidence, promising to strengthen Lebanon's weak state. For example, vowing to make sure only the state bears arms, an implicit promise to disarm Hezbollah, Lebanon's most powerful militia. Aoun will also be key in implementing a ceasefire with Israel. After his speech, a celebratory band kicked into high gear. But for Aoun's presidency, this is just the start. He now has to marshal Lebanon's fractious parliament and find enough consensus to appoint a prime minister and a cabinet before any real work can begin. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beirut.
This is NPR News.
We've heard the stories of the Southern California wildfires from the people who have lived in the path of the flames. We'll continue to bring you the latest coverage as we learn it on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, Bad Bunny was born and raised in Puerto Rico.
The Grammy winner has a new album out, and it's being called his most Puerto Rican yet.
He's really giving up space to allow new artists to represent their sounds, and there's nothing more quintessentially Puerto Rican than that.
That's ahead, First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Wind-driven wildfires continue to rage across Los Angeles County. Mandatory evacuation orders have been issued for nearly 180,000 people in several communities. Greg Napier and his wife were forced from their home in the city of Altadena on Wednesday.
The whole neighborhood's still burning right now on my street. Only three houses are standing. Out of 40, all the rest of them lost their house. So you can see in the garages, their cars just burnt to the ground.
The wildfire burning in Pacific Palisades has grown to more than 17,000 acres with zero containment. Former President Jimmy Carter made his final journey back to Georgia after today's funeral at Washington, D.C.'s National Cathedral. Sam Greenglass of member station WABE reports Carter was buried in Plains, the southwest Georgia town where he lived for most of a century.
As the sun began to dip, visitors and neighbors waving American flags lined the main drag of this tiny downtown to say a final goodbye. Some from faraway states, others closer to home. Terry Wooden says Carter means a lot to people in this isolated region.
Where there are not a lot of resources, not a lot of attention, and frankly, not a lot of hope sometimes, but to see someone who could come from the meager beginnings and be able to be one of the most powerful people in the world. You know, it says to them, you're not boxed in, that anything is possible.
And she says she wanted to be here so she can tell her grandchildren about the man from Plains who became president. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Plains, Georgia.
This is NPR News. The Supreme Court has rejected President-elect Donald Trump's attempt to halt his sentencing in his criminal hush money case in New York on Friday. Trump had argued that as president-elect, he's immune from all prosecution and sentencing. Trump was convicted last summer on 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments made to an adult film star ahead of the 2016 election. The state of Florida is suing Trinity Healthcare Services, whose former CEO is a Florida congresswoman. The suit alleges the state overpaid Trinity by millions at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, and it wants the money paid back. Carlton Gillespie from member station WLRN reports.
The company was contracted to perform vaccine registrations in February of 2021. In one of the overpayments from the Florida Department of Emergency Management, Trinity Healthcare received more than $5 million for an invoice of just over $50,000. The suit alleges that Trinity Healthcare took advantage of the pandemic and knowingly cashed a check 100 times the size of its usual invoice. The state tried to remedy its error this past June by demanding the money back, but the company refused. Trinity Healthcare received the alleged overpayments when Congresswoman Sheila Shervilus McCormick was its CEO. She stepped down in 2021 to run for Congress as a Democrat. For NPR News, I'm Carlton Gillespie in Fort Lauderdale.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprises using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes, to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Catastrophic wildfires continue to rage out of control across Greater Los Angeles. The two most destructive fires have already totaled thousands of structures. The Palisades Fire is burning in the Santa Monica Mountains near the Pacific Coast, and inland to the east, the Eaton Fire is encroaching on the city of Pasadena. The community of Altadena is just north of Pasadena, and it's seen some of the worst damage. That's where some of the officials planning disaster response are doing so, having fled or even, in some cases, having lost their homes. Victoria Knapp is chair of the Altadena Town Council, and she joins us now. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Victoria, I want to start by asking about your personal experience. What has this been like for you and your family? Were you among those who had to evacuate?
We were among the first to evacuate because the eastern edge of the fire was just outside the canyon of our home. So I'm a Gen Xer, and I've been through a lot and I've seen a lot. And I don't have a word in the English language that can express what this experience has been like, but to say that it is utter devastation and trauma. Hmm.
Tell us what the community there looks like today from what you've seen. How much have you been able to see the damage there for yourself?
I was able to get up to our home yesterday, which we unfortunately lost completely to the fire. I live on a cul-de-sac of 15 homes. Two were left standing. There is a lot of widespread debris from the windstorm, so that's creating a lot of problems for first responders and for those that are going to initiate the cleanup efforts to get through town. We are a small foothill town of about 45,000 residents, and we rely and support small businesses. And when I tell you probably half of our small businesses are gone to the ground, that would not be an overstatement. So it's obviously smoky still. There are active fires burning, but the most stark visual is just that of a post-apocalyptic war zone. That's how I would describe it.
I know people must be feeling a whole wide range of emotions right now. Tell us what you're hearing from people in your community. What do they need right now?
The thing that the people of Altadena need most is information. One of the problems with Altadena being as remote as it is and part of unincorporated LA County is that there is no centralized communication operation. The Altadena Town Council is working right now on our statement, which will have all of the local, state, and federal resources so that those most impacted can start to take advantage of those and begin to move forward in the healing process. We need information immediately because there are things that most people don't consider, like, what do you do with your mail when both your home has burned down and the post office has burned down? What happens then? What do we do about shutting off gas to homes where people are in a neighborhood that isn't evacuated?
Victoria, I understand that winds are forecast to pick up before things start to get better. I wonder, to what degree can you even think about rebuilding yet?
We can't. We have to get past this crisis first. It's hard to imagine more disaster because the degree of catastrophe is so high already. So the rebuilding is really one of spirit, honestly. In fact, the town council is going to put together a gathering. It won't be in Altadena, but we want to be able to give space for residents to come together so that we can hug, we can communicate what we know and have learned, and so that everyone feels the support and love of their neighbor.
Victoria Knapp is chair of the Altadena Town Council near the Eaton Fire in Southern California. Victoria, we're thinking about your community and wishing you the best.
We appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Tens of thousands of years ago, nearly 24 kangaroo species vanished, part of a great extinction event. Science reporter Ari Daniel says hundreds of prehistoric teeth may now help paleontologists figure out why.
Kangaroos evolved from a possum-like ancestor. Then, some 8 million years ago,
Australia became quite arid. That was where kangaroos really hit their strides, or I suppose their hops, and diversified into a lot of different groups.
Sam Arman is a paleontologist at Megafauna Central, a natural history museum in Australia. He says there were two major groups of kangaroos, the long-faced ones,
which is what you still see today, and that includes things like wallabies,
and the short-faced ones.
So basically, if you clonked a koala head on top of it, you're basically in the right ballpark, just less floofy.
Then, in the late Pleistocene, 40 to 65,000 years ago, many of these kangaroos went extinct. And the question is, why?
The question has been plaguing paleontology for a couple of hundred years. It really does come down to two arguments.
The first being whether humans who arrived in Australia around this time had something to do with it, perhaps by hunting the kangaroos or altering the landscape, or whether it was related to a change in climate.
If these kangaroos were all just feeding on particular sorts of plants, then perhaps climate change came in and wiped out those plants, and then they were extinct because of that.
This idea that their food disappeared relies on the kangaroos having been specialized eaters, which some paleontologists believe, based on differences in kangaroos' skull shape and chemistry, that short-faced kangaroos fed primarily on shrubs and long-faced kangaroos mostly on grasses. Arman, however, wasn't so sure.
Adaptation does not necessarily define diet.
So he approached the question of ancient kangaroo extinction by taking a detailed look at the teeth of more than 900 kangaroos, a mix of fossils from a cave in South Australia and modern animals from across the country.
Whenever an animal chews its food, the food leaves marks, microscopic scratches on the surface of the teeth. If we scan them under a very high resolution microscope, we can then compare what these fossil animals were eating at the time.
Arman and his colleagues found that most of the extinct kangaroos, both the short and long-faced ones, had mixed diets. That is, he says they ate both grasses and shrubs based on what was available. He suggests that starvation brought on by a changing climate may not have wiped them out, and the arrival of humans may have.
It doesn't rule out that climate change is involved in some other way, but it's very hard to tell the story without invoking humans in any way.
The research is published in the journal Science.
This paper is really helpful in sort of reconstructing what the ecology was, but I think it goes a little bit too far in trying to make the claim that these kangaroos were sort of already well adapted to variable climate change.
Larissa DeSantis is a paleontologist at Vanderbilt University. She leans towards climate change having more to do with the extinctions. So she says the new research doesn't capture the full picture.
It's really important to see if we can disentangle the impacts of climate and humans in the past so that we can better understand the impacts that we're having on current ecosystems.
This is a point that Sam Arman agrees with. He hopes the kangaroos that ended their time on Earth in the Pleistocene might help the kangaroos of today escape a similar fate. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. More and more Americans need home health care. Finding a caregiver is hard. The pay is low and turnover is high, which is why Nevada has been raising caregiver wages. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
Thomas Dre is a high school science teacher. Almost 20 years ago, he was in a car crash.
Yeah, in 2005, my buddy ran a red light.
He suffered a spinal injury that left him unable to use his legs. Since then, he's needed help getting out of bed, getting cleaned, getting dressed, and getting in his van to go to school. That help hasn't always been reliable.
I would have people coming and going or not showing up to get me up, and I wouldn't go to school that day.
Then came Irma Nunez. For the past 12 years, she's been at his house 20-some hours a week.
What is it, 23?
Like 23, 24 and a half, around there. Mm-hmm.
That's how much Medicaid covers every week.
I come a.m. and I come p.m. every single day.
In the mornings, she's there at 4:30 so that Dre can make it to school by 6 a.m., an hour before the kids get there.
I wouldn't be able to go to school or work if it wasn't for Irma.
After school, she returns to help Dre get back into his house and back into bed. The work is taxing. And a year ago, she was earning the going rate, around $11 an hour.
I always thought it was just crazy they made such little amount of money.
To make ends meet, Nunez used to pick up as much work as she could, taking on multiple clients, driving from house to house, a couple hours here, a couple hours there, 7 days a week.
You see a lot of people needing you, so you help them. You know, you help them, and that makes you feel good.
Still, she was frustrated, not just with her low pay, but her lack of health insurance and other benefits.
No PTO, no vacations, no nothing. I don't work, I don't get paid.
So she jumped at the chance to do something about it. In 2023, she and other caregivers took their fight to the Nevada legislature with backing from the union, SEIU. They asked the state to send more Medicaid dollars to the agencies that employ them, so the agencies in turn could pay them more. The caregivers shined a light on how hard their days are, bathing and feeding patients, helping them go to the bathroom. Turned out they had a receptive audience.
People told us personal stories about their dads, moms, grandparents, so they knew what we were talking about.
And in the 2023 budget bill, Nevada lawmakers granted their wishes. They even set a new $16 minimum wage for home care workers, far higher than the state minimum wage. It took effect in January last year.
First paycheck, I'm all like, oh, wow, like way different.
Now, a year later, the wage boost is proving to be game-changing for the industry, too. It used to be that half of home care workers in Nevada didn't even last a year. In the 4 months after the new minimum wage took effect, turnover fell to almost nothing. Home health agencies have been growing their ranks at a faster clip, and so has the union. Since 2023, 1,000 caregivers have voted to unionize to have a bigger voice. And when the Nevada legislature convenes again next month, Irma Nunez will be part of a larger contingent of caregivers demanding another raise.
Maybe from 16 to 20, or if possible, higher, because we need it.
She says her rent keeps going up. Her car needs new tires. She still has no health insurance. And at 58, she herself is dealing with all kinds of health problems.
I'm older. I'm older, and I'm not the Irma that used to be.
A $20 wage, she says, would help her save a little money for her own retirement. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Henderson, Nevada.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Bad Bunny has multiple Grammy Awards, record streaming numbers, and is generally one of the world's biggest pop stars. But no matter how famous he gets, the focus of his music always comes back to Puerto Rico, where he was born and raised. And his new record is being called his most Puerto Rican and most political album yet. Aunt Latino's Ana Maria Sayer has been listening to the new Bad Bunny album since it was released on Sunday and joins us now. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
Ana, let me start by asking you this. Tell me how you hear Puerto Rico on this album.
You know, Juana, it's hard to find a moment on Debí Tirar Más Fotos that doesn't feel distinctly Puerto Rican. What he's effectively doing is using this album to do a survey of Puerto Rican music, past and present. He's pulling on traditional sounds like the jirabe, which is folk music from the campo, historic Afro-Puerto Rican bomba y plena protest music, and New Yorican diasporic salsa. Seamlessly marries that with dembow and reggaeton, the music that made him famous, and other contemporary Puerto Rican sounds. Beyond that, he's spotlighting new talent on the island. Some of his songs are so stylistically distinct and representative of the most contemporary, exciting sounds on the island, it almost feels as though he's featured on the music. And really, giving up space like that, there's nothing more quintessentially Puerto Rican to me than that.
And the sounds that we hear, is he using them to make political statements about Puerto Rico?
You know, Puerto Rico just had some really historic elections in November. A third-party candidate got a huge amount of support from across the island, and a lot of people are saying that musicians, including Bad Bunny, had a lot to do with that. Bad Bunny has now gone and released a record that pretty overtly expresses some of these same political opinions. Take the song Lo Que Le Pasó a Hawaii. In this song, he's expressing an anti-statehood stance, basically warning Puerto Ricans what could happen if they go the way of statehood like Hawaii. There's an urgency to the Puerto Rican pride he's expressing, and you can hear it in every second of the record.
Do you think there's any sort of risk for Bad Bunny as a pop star to making an album like this one, which is so culturally specific?
You know, while the challenges and pain he's exploring are specifically dire in Puerto Rico, they really are widely felt across Latin America. Take the song Turista. He's obviously referring to tourism, which is a major challenge on the island right now, but using this conceit of a jilted lover, expressing the pains of the island through the perspective of a heartbroken person. Now, this is a device that is used in Latin music all over the place. So it's something that a lot of people can relate to, both conceptually with international gentrification on the rise, and musically.
Ana, what do you think this album tells us about Bad Bunny at this specific moment in his career?
Bad Bunny has always been celebrated for being politically vocal. His last record was actually a moment of reprieve from that. He spent more time talking about the struggles of fame in a way that had some people questioning whether he still wanted to be so political. In this record, he claims he's not being political. He's just talking about things he cares about. But in Debí Tirar Más Fotos, he's a grown-up Bad Bunny. He's reflective, thinking about the passage of time and where he fits into the story of his island. It's clear that in the time he did spend away, he realized that nothing matters more than Puerto Rico.
That's NPR's Ana Maria Sayer, a host of Alt Latino. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A NASA rover on Mars has been collecting samples of rock and sealing them into metal tubes. NASA wants to launch a robotic mission that would pick up these samples and return them to Earth. That has been a challenge. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has an update.
Samples of rock have been brought back from the moon, from asteroids, but never from another planet. So when NASA designed the Perseverance rover, they sent along tubes made of titanium. The rover has been busy filling them up with samples of rocks, dirt, the Martian atmosphere. NASA wants to bring 30 of these tubes back to Earth so that their contents can be analyzed in a secure lab. The goal is to learn more about the history of the red planet, such as whether it ever had life.
We want to have the quickest, cheapest way to get these 30 samples back.
That's NASA Administrator Bill Nelson speaking at a press briefing on Tuesday. He says the original plan to get the rocks back was turning out to be slow and expensive. Projected costs ballooned to $11 billion, with a return date as far off as 2040.
This thing had gotten out of control.
So last year, top officials pulled the plug and hit the reset button. NASA solicited ideas from industry and outside experts. And now Nelson says NASA will spend some time simultaneously exploring two different mission options. One will rely on tried and true technologies for getting to Mars that have been used in previous missions, plus simplified components of the original plan. The other option will take advantage of emerging commercial capabilities. NASA will work on the engineering for both and eventually pick one.
The final decision is likely to come in 2026.
Planetary scientists who have long been eager to bring Mars rocks home paid close attention to his words. Jack Mustard is with Brown University.
I'm heartened to hear the administrator say, you know, I can see a path forward. I mean, I think that's the bottom line, right? They see a path forward.
That was by no means guaranteed. This sense of relief was echoed by Vicki Hamilton, a planetary geologist with the Southwest Research Institute, although she had been hoping to hear what the mission would look like.
I am disappointed a little bit that we still don't know exactly what the architecture will be.
Still, she says NASA really hasn't had much time to think about the various proposals it got from industry.
So I can understand that they want to take a little more time to look at that.
And she was happy to hear that NASA wants to retrieve all 30 samples, rather than making do with a smaller selection. She says these carefully assembled samples could reveal whether or not Mars was ever home to ancient life.
We're going to the right place and collecting the right samples to do the best job we can at trying to answer that question.
The incoming Trump administration and Congress will weigh in on all this, plus the European Space Agency, NASA's partner in this effort. Meanwhile, China has been pursuing its own project to collect and return a Martian rock. Nelson called it more of a grab-and-go mission. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Drexel University, whose model of experiential education allows students to choose their own path and explore the world, enabling them to discover their perfect career. More at drexel.edu. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At Progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the John S. and James L. Knight.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at GCI.com/internet. Ain't no hope.